Our show today is going to continue to be about the genocide in Gaza. I'm going to be brief because our tracks are very tightly fitted to the show today. First, an interview with Judge Neopolitano interviewing Professor Jeffrey Sachs. Next, Al Jazeera, the show The Listening Post. And finally, a commentary by Chris Hayes, saying that Biden leaves a legacy of disgrace. So, up first, Jeffrey Sachs with Judge Neopolitano.
Hi, everyone. Judge Andrew Neopolitano here for Judging Freedom. Today is Tuesday, January 14th, 2025. Professor Jeffrey Sachs joins us now. Professor Sachs, always a pleasure. My dear friend, no matter where you are in the world, you always seem to find time for this show and for the viewers who admire your work. You may very well have changed the course of history with your comment at the Cambridge student union a few months ago, which resonated with the president-elect who posted it, and which obviously had some kind of an effect. Prime Minister Netanyahu has declined to attend President Trump's inauguration. I don't know if he's afraid to fly here, afraid that his plane may have to land somewhere where he could be arrested, but clearly the criticism that you leveled, so soundly accepted by so many people around the world, was embraced by the president and used as an elect and used as a negotiating technique. So now, if there is a deal to release Israeli hostages and to release Palestinian hostages, Joe Biden will take credit and Donald Trump will take credit. I'm talking to the man who caused this to happen.
No. But I would say that if there is a deal, by the way, it shows that there is leverage, that the United States doesn't have to follow the foreign policy of some other country. The United States can follow its own policy. If there is a deal, this is Donald Trump's accomplishment. Joe Biden, I'm sorry to say, for years has just gone along with what other countries have told the U.S. to do. And this ceasefire should have happened a long time ago. If it comes, and it should come, it is coming through pressure that should have been applied a long time ago. This is a basic point. We've been discussing it not only about the war in the Middle East, but also the war in Ukraine. If you give your foreign policy, that is the United States foreign policy, to some other government to say, well, everything that we decide is going to be determined by the Ukrainians or it's going to be determined by the Israelis, believe me, we will not get what is in the interest of the United States. And by the way, we won't even get what is in the real interest of those other countries. We'll get what is in the interest, perhaps, of a few politicians in those other countries who suddenly have the U.S. at their beck and call. But that doesn't mean that they're serving their own countries properly. And certainly a president of the United States should be saying to other governments, no, you don't determine our foreign policy. So this is what I hope is now starting to happen. It's been a long time,
yes,
where the U.S. has been absurdly manipulated to the U.S. disadvantage. Now, diplomatic isolation, endless wars, and so on. Maybe something is going to change at this point.
I ask this firmly with tongue in cheek, but have you heard from Prime Minister Netanyahu or from President-elect Trump?
Well, that is very much tongue in cheek. I heard from President Trump only indirectly, being on Truth Social, so that was an interesting way to hear. I did not hear from Prime Minister Netanyahu, although I did hear from one of his ministers who roundly attacked me following an interview that I had with Tucker Carlson. And I responded. I was happy to respond in the Israeli media that the things that I am saying are not even against Israel. The criticisms that I'm making are against a government that is not serving the purpose of its people and is a disservice to world peace. And what that, unfortunately, has been what Netanyahu has been for a very long time.
What you said was to articulate the observation, the truthful observation, that Netanyahu personally has been behind every war the United States has recently fought in the Middle East, as fruitless, useless, and destructive as they have been, and that he is a deep, dark SOB. And that is the part that Trump posted. So he was obviously sending a message to Netanyahu. I may be Israel's best friend, but you're not going to tell me how to run, unlike you do with Joe Biden, how to run American foreign policy. And for that, when did you say this? When was the talk at Cambridge? It was a while ago. It was 2024, yeah,
It was in 2024. I don't remember exactly the dates. It was a quick visit through the UK. So I had a chance to go to Oxford and to Cambridge and to meet with students there. And they were interested in foreign policy. Why are there so many wars? Why does this danger continue to escalate? And that was the context in which I spoke. But we do know a lot now from participants in the Iraq war. We do know how Netanyahu came and was a great cheerleader of this war. We do know, unfortunately, the role that the Israel lobby played in stoking that war, a war of false pretenses. We do know, unfortunately, again, of a basic political strategy that dates back to a document called Clean Break. In 1996, when Netanyahu first became prime minister in Israel, with American political advisors tightly linked with the American political system. And the clean break was the break with the international process of land for peace. In other words, the idea that there would be a Palestinian state alongside Israel, as determined by international law, and that peace would come in that context. And what Netanyahu came to power determined to do was to prevent a Palestinian state. This was against international law. This was a claim of territory that Israel would continue to rule over millions of Palestinian people. But his assertion was, we can do this because we will, with you, the United States, I should add, overthrow governments that support the opposition to our policies. And when Hamas or Hezbollah or other groups fight Israel, well, the governments in the region that support them, we will overthrow them. You should go to war with them. That was the idea. What an idea. Instead of saying there should be diplomacy, there should be an agreement based on peace, Israel said, no, no, we will have it all, and you will go to war so that we have it all. Now, we have an incoming U.S. government that has expressed in the past with President Trump, very strong, unreserved support for Israel. And many people around President Trump have said in the past, well, yes, we can ignore the Palestinian question because other governments in the region especially Saudi Arabia, will make peace with Israel, and they don't care about the Palestinians. They don't care whether there is a Palestinian state. They don't care whether Israel is occupying a territory or fighting absolutely brutal, unnecessary wars, killing tens of thousands of people. They don't care. But that's false. What President Trump is going to find, and I think he knows this, but what he's going to find when he comes into office in a few days is that the Saudi government, which is an important ally of the United States, is saying absolutely clearly, we can have peace in the Middle East. We can, of course, have normal relations with Israel. We can end this bloodshed, but it requires a state of Palestine living in peace next to the state of Israel. This is what all of the world has been saying for years, except the government of Israel under Netanyahu and the United States government, which under Biden did every single thing that Netanyahu said. And so we gave up our foreign policy. Israel under Netanyahu pursued a radical foreign policy. War has spread. Netanyahu was betting that when President Trump comes in, not only will the war spread, but the United States will go to war against Iran. That's the last one on Netanyahu's list that the United States hasn't fought so far. But what President Trump will hear from every country in the region, from the Saudis, from all of the countries in the Gulf, from Egypt, from Jordan, from the new government in Lebanon, from Turkey, and from Iran. Yes, from Iran. I know it because I hear it directly in my conversations with the leadership of that country. There can be peace. There can be normal relations with Israel, but only with a state of Palestine alongside Israel so that the region can go to peace. So this is what I'm really hoping, not just for a ceasefire in the next days, which would be wonderful news, but true peace in the Middle East. And I would like nothing more than a tremendous success of President Trump at the start of his administration to help guide, for the first time in decades, a real peace in the Middle East. But it requires that the United States exercise its own foreign policy to say to the Israelis, whether you like it or not, international law, the UN Security Council, the UN General Assembly, the G20, the BRICS, the Arab League, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, the whole world is saying we want peace, no more of these wars on behalf of an untenable Israeli policy. If President Trump will do this, this would change history for the good. This would make the world tremendously safer. This would achieve peace in the Middle East. And it's not impossible that this could happen.
We may see a historic change sooner than we think, because ministers Ben-Gvir and Smotrich are threatening to resign from the Netanyahu government. As I understand it, that might bring him under the 61 votes he needs in the Knesset, which will collapse his government and force elections in Israel.
People should understand who Ben-Gvir and Smotrich are. They are not only core to Netanyahu's government right now, they are complete extremists. They are the ones that say, without any scruples, without any recognition of international law, or any morals, as I would say it, we will control everything. All of the occupied lands, annex them, push out the Palestinians, the ones that aren't killed under the U.S. bombs that the U.S. has been giving to us under Biden, to kill tens of thousands of innocent women and children, destroy the hospitals, destroy the infrastructure of Gaza. Those are the two that have been the most extremist in the government. If they leave because they can't even accept a ceasefire, this is what we are really facing. And during the Biden administration, it was that extremism that was U.S. foreign policy until today, until even Blinken asked about this in his recent interview. He said, I can't see anything wrong with what Israel was doing, basically. They were just defending themselves. No, what they were doing was destroying a population in order to assert full illegal control over occupied territories and to prevent a state of Palestine living in peace side by side with Israel. That's what they were doing. So if these two leave, this is the breakthrough.
Chris, I'd like you to look for that clip of Secretary Blinken being asked about, are you, by the New York Times reporter, are you worried that history will view you as having presided over genocide while Professor Sachs and I speak? Was Benjamin Netanyahu involved in the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin?
Oh, I don't think so. I don't know. I don't think so. But what I do believe is that the extremism and the zealotry was responsible for the death of a peacemaker, because Yitzhak Rabin was the last prime minister of Israel that really tried to have a state of Palestine and a state of Israel as the basis of peace. And he was killed not by an Arab jihadist. No, he was killed by a Jewish zealot of the kind that is in power today. And many of the political supporters of the government in power today, one could say, cheered or approved, some even celebrated the death of a peacemaker. Well, this is known throughout history. I don't think Netanyahu, God forbid, but it wouldn't cross my mind that he himself played any role in that. But the extremism in Israel became real. And that extremism has been the base of the Netanyahu policies for years, which is to say there is no way to peace. They just want to kill us on the other side, so we have to do what we have to do. This is the big lie.
Right.
Here's which has brought us so many of these wars.
Here's Blinken, Secretary Blinken on genocide. Please watch his, it's a short clip. Please watch his body language, Jeff.
Do you, Secretary Blinken, worry that perhaps you have been presiding over what the world will see as a genocide?
No, it's not, first of all. Second, as to how the world sees it, I can't fully answer to that. But everyone has to look at the facts and draw their own conclusions from those facts. And my conclusions are clear.
You're digging a hole deeper.
Well, it's not everyone has to look at the facts and draw their own conclusions. There is, of course, an urgent, globally watched case being adjudicated right now in the International Court of Justice, brought by the government of South Africa, joined by many other governments that say on the basis of extraordinarily detailed briefs that Israel is in rampant, gross, flagrant violation of the 1948 Genocide Convention. So Secretary Blinken isn't going to be able to just say, well, that's your opinion and my opinion is different. We will have a careful, detailed scrutiny of this, which is underway right now. It's shocking to read the briefs that have been put in on this issue, because they are detailed, they are harrowing, they are extraordinarily unpleasant to read, describing the intentionality of Israeli leaders to make Gaza completely unlivable, the celebration of Israeli Defense Force troops posted on TikTok and others as Gaza is destroyed, the targeting of hospitals, schools, clinics, mosques, water supplies, power, basic infrastructure, the denial of the most urgent relief, food supplies, medical supplies, the lack of anesthetics as surgeons are operating on children without anesthetic who have been wounded in Israeli bombings, and then the doctors themselves being killed, even sending messages to their loved ones. I have to continue on my duty until the end. And Israel destroying these hospitals, and this is not even hidden. This is posted on videos day by day. So no, Antony Blinken, it's not true that, well, you have your opinion and someone else has some different opinion. There is evidence. This is happening before our eyes. This is recorded. This is collected and collated. This is being reviewed by the justices of the International Court of Justice. This is a real charge. This is not some word that's being bandied around. This is about a violation of the 1948 Genocide Convention. I believe that the court will rule soon. If it does rule that Israel has committed acts of genocide, and it's quite possible that it will, one thing is also certain, and that is that the U.S. leadership, including Blinken, including President Biden, including Jake Sullivan, including other security leaders, have been complicit in these actions. This is what is shocking for me as an American. What Israel does, I find despicable in this context. The fact that the Biden administration, to this moment, as we just saw from Antony Blinken, said, nope, I don't see the harm there. That, to me, as an American, is an unbelievable abnegation of responsibility.
Here's what the highest ranking person to resign over this from the Blinken Department of State told 60 Minutes 2 days ago, cut number 10.
Most of the bombs come from America. Most of the technology comes from America, and all of the fighter jets, all of Israel's fixed-wing fleet, comes from America. There is a linkage between every single bomb that is dropped in Gaza and the U.S., because every single bomb that is dropped from an American-made plane.
These Israeli airstrikes, you could say, are made in America.
They are.
True.
Israel could not fight one day without the United States funding, arming, providing diplomatic cover, using its veto in the United Nations, providing intelligence, In other words, complete and total engagement in what has happened. We don't really know, and I think we will find out more whether President Biden has even been of the state of mind to be president during this period fully. He is in responsibility. I don't know who's been making the decisions, but the decisions that have been made have been to allow Israel to do what Netanyahu has said. And while there have been murmurs of unhappiness or concern expressed by Mr. Blinken over the past months, those concerns have meant nothing in practice because the U.S. has given a blank check. It's been Blinken who has certified that Israel is operating within international and American law, a false certification. So the complicity is very intensive. It's not a casual complicity. It's a deep complicity.
Professor Sachs, thank you very much. My dear friend, you are a living example that intellectual honesty and personal courage can sometimes bend the arc of history. Look forward to seeing.
Yeah, thank you. Let's just hope that President Trump comes in and does what he has said, which is to make America sovereign again, yes, so that we have our own foreign policy, we pursue our own interests, and our interests are in peace in the Middle East with two states living side by side, Palestine and Israel. If President Trump does this, I want to be in the front of the parade to get him a Nobel Peace Prize. First thing, it's within his reach. I so dearly hope that he'll follow the path of peace on this.
Same here, Professor Sachs. Thank you very much. Safe travels. We'll see you next week.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
That was Judge Napolitano with Jeffrey Sachs. Coming up next, we have Al Jazeera program, The Listening Post, from the 11th of January, 2025.
It took 15 months of its war on Gaza, but the Israeli military has finally figured out the obvious. Having your soldiers posting evidence of war crimes on social media and celebrating them comes with consequences, legal ones.
Work with President Trump.
Mark Zuckerberg and Meta cave in anticipation of Donald Trump's return to the White House. And what does Trump administration number two have in store for legacy media outlets? Where does mainstream journalism in the U.S. go from here? The October 7th attacks by Hamas and Israel's genocidal response have shaken several Middle Eastern countries to their foundations. That includes Israel itself, where the news media provide a window into a nation initially gripped by grief that then turned to revenge. That picture, however, has started to shift. At the liberal end of the Israeli spectrum, expressions of guilt, even anger over the onslaught in Gaza have been surfacing, with more and more Israeli voices using terms such as ethnic cleansing, even genocide, to describe it. And there is alarm over how Israel's devastation of Gaza may come home to roost, sparked by the news that Brazil launched an investigation into an Israeli soldier on holiday there for war crimes, and the implications that has for hundreds of other soldiers who have incriminated themselves on social media, which is why 46,000 Palestinian lives later, the Israeli army has now taken extraordinary steps when it comes to both the mainstream media and social media to stop showing the faces of its homegrown war criminals. Four interviews on the genocide Israel continues to inflict on Palestinians in Gaza. Two from Israel, done over Zoom, since Al Jazeera has been banned there. One from the U.S., and one with a Palestinian human rights researcher in central Gaza, what is left of it.
We're talking about 80% of the population that even if they were allowed to go to their homes, they will not actually find homes. They will live on the rubble this suffering will continue for decades, not just years, decades.
Despite all the evidence, much of it posted by its own soldiers on social media, Israel still insists it's not committing war crimes, let alone a genocide. But more and more countries see past the propaganda. Like Brazil, where a judge recently ordered that an Israeli soldier on holiday there be investigated for his role in Gaza. The Israelis got him out before charges could be laid. The case produced a panicky response in Israeli news studios because of its implications.
Argentina, Chile, Brazil, מדינות שיש להם סמכות שיפוט אוניברסלית ומאוד קל להעמיד, וכמובן תאילנד, יעד פופולרי שמחפשים שם משרד עורכי דין, וזה כנראה ילך ויגבר, אבל...
Army chiefs then declared that from now on, the identities of Israeli soldiers will be hidden from the world, their faces blurred in interviews, plus a ban on soldiers posting their exploits on social media. It's too little, much too late. Soldiers have already provided mountains of online evidence for war crimes investigators, which, as a former Israeli Army Chief of Staff pointed out, is not the only evidence out there.
שיפסיקו להוציא החוצה כל מיני סרטונים וכל מיני אמירות, אבל זה לא יעזור להם, הפוליטיקאים ידברו על זה שבעצם אנחנו מתכוונים לדלל או לנקות האוכלוסייה, זה פשע מלחמה, אז לא?
The Israeli news outlet Ya'alon was speaking on, Ynet, has since posted an online guide for Israeli soldiers on how to avoid arrest overseas and what to do if that happens.
Their own soldiers have been taking to social media, going on Instagram, going on TikTok, and posting videos of war crimes. So part of the reason why Israel is in this crisis is because their own soldiers have been going onto social media and broadcasting their own war crimes.
The fact that there has been an article in one of the mainstream Israeli web portals saying, here's a guide for reservists about how to protect yourself when you go abroad so you don't fall under threat of prosecution. This is a kind of mind-boggling thing that Israelis didn't really ever have to worry about, but those kinds of efforts to prosecute them have only been possible when those very same soldiers themselves have incriminated themselves in war crimes.
There's been an explicit push to delete social media posts, certain things you shouldn't say in public, which is rather startling because instead of saying, if you think they are war crimes, you shouldn't partake in them, you should refuse, the push is, this is how you should hide them. The shame isn't translated into taking action in refusing to partake in the genocide, but rather to sort of be ashamed that the world sees us in this position, we should hide it better.
Other changes in the Israeli media space include some of the terminology now seeping into the debate. That ex-Army Chief of Staff, Moshe Ya'alon, set off shockwaves in early December by openly calling Israel's tactics in Gaza ethnic cleansing.
בוא ללכת בדרך שכרגע גוררים אותנו, לכבוש, לספח, לטהר טיהור אתני, תסתכלו על צפון הרצועה.
As if emboldened by Ya'alon, a collection of center-left voices has since followed his lead, some of them injecting another taboo term, genocide, into the discussion. International audiences have been hearing such terminology for months, a problem the Israeli government is now spending more money on. It has made a dramatic increase to its Hasbara or propaganda budget, allocating another $150 million to target the foreign press, social media platforms, and college campuses, treating the symptoms rather than curing the disease.
I don't think the start of improving Israel's image is to write a nice message, to trot out the right people who look earnest in conversation abroad.
The thing that the Israeli government wants more than anything is to bring back our people.
I don't dismiss the necessity of communication, but it has to start from a genuine change of reality and political policy.
In terms of the amount of money, $150 million increase to what they were already going to spend on public diplomacy, it just underscores the extent of the crisis here. You can't put lipstick on a pig, and no amount of money spent on public diplomacy is going to be able to erase all of these images that people have been seeing now on social media.
The circular relationship between Israel and the world is such that Israel does something objectionable or criticizable, and then the world criticizes it, and then Israel cries anti-Semitism.
The singling out of the one and only Jewish state.
And then Israel invests in money and effort just to show the world why actually the world is anti-Semitic and it is always right. Israel is just investing all its efforts into changing its image rather than rethinking its actions.
All of this is unfolding as Israel presses on with its attacks on Gaza, including what remains of its hospitals and media corps. The day after Christmas, five employees of Al-Quds, a TV news outlet affiliated with Palestinian Islamic Jihad, were killed in an airstrike, the worst massacre of journalists of the entire war. Babies, forced to live in tents, are succumbing to hypothermia, freezing to death. Ceasefire talks have resumed, but there is little to no reason to believe that Israel will meet Hamas's demand for a full withdrawal from Gaza. The pressure on Israel to return to the negotiating table intensified last weekend after Hamas released a video of one of the few dozen captives said to be still alive, a 19-year-old named Liri Albag.
Liri Albag has been one of the more prominent hostages in the Israeli consciousness because her family have been very outspoken. In the video, she's like a shell of a human being in very poor physical condition. Hamas has been releasing these kinds of videos to generate public demands towards a ceasefire deal. The Israeli government call it psychological terror. Israelis don't care what you call it. A growing majority are willing to end the war for the sake of getting the hostages back.
The video of Liri Albag hasn't been broadcast in Israeli mainstream media in its full. The use of uniform here is supplied by Hamas. It's to remind Israelis that she is a soldier. It's a reminder of the contradictions of the deep militarism of Israeli society that sends 19-year-old girls to serve in the military, but then still treats them as young women, like they're still the vulnerable young women that they actually are. It is incredibly hard for all of us to watch these videos.
On the captives, there's another much larger group that gets minimal Israeli or international attention, the Palestinians rotting away in Israeli jails in their thousands. A wildly disproportionate amount of the focus goes to the dozens of Israeli captives who have yet to be brought home. And away from the bigger picture, the genocide in Gaza, a population now made up almost entirely of refugees, living in tents as Israeli bombs keep raining down in places like Deir al-Balah.
Deir al-Balah now houses more than 1 million Palestinians concentrated in this pretty much refugee camp. Is very dangerous. The smallest bomb dropped on any neighborhood in Deir al-Balah can result in a massacre. This genocide on Gaza, it was never about only releasing the hostages. Israel wanted to teach the Palestinians a lesson to destroy the whole of the Gaza Strip. And even if Israel were to agree to a ceasefire deal now, the attacks will continue on Palestinians in the whole of Palestine.
Some of America's corporate big boys are tripping over themselves, trying to curry favor with Donald Trump and his incoming administration. But few companies have been as active and as blatant as Mark Zuckerberg's Meta. Meenakshi Ravi is here with the details.
Keeping up with the pace of change at Meta since Trump's election victory has become something of an endurance sport. The latest announcement from Chairman and CEO Mark Zuckerberg was significant, not just because of the content of his statement, but the very obvious tone of deference towards Trump.
The recent elections also feel like a cultural tipping point towards once again prioritizing speech.
According to Zuckerberg, Meta's fact-checking and content moderation had gone too far and had resulted in censorship. So, professional fact-checking will be replaced by users flagging and correcting inaccuracies. Restrictions on contentious topics like immigration and gender will be lifted. And Zuckerberg went further.
We're going to work with President Trump to push back on governments around the world pushing to censor more.
There's been reams of analysis on the changes coming to Meta. The broad consensus is that in an era of accelerating disinformation, there is reason to be very concerned. It's not that all the changes are bad. For instance, the user-based approach to flagging inaccuracies is more open and democratic than outsourced content moderation. Also, no one is arguing that Meta's platforms don't have a censorship problem. However, this is a blatant pivot by Zuckerberg. Back in 2021, Meta issued an indefinite ban on Trump after he instigated the January 6th riots. That ban was lifted in 2023, and since Trump's re-election, Meta has made a $1 million contribution to Trump's inauguration celebrations. Zuckerberg dined with Trump at his Florida resort, and there have been changes to senior staffing, with Republicans being swapped in at the board level. All of this looks less like Zuckerberg is restoring free speech and more about big tech making nice with the White House.
Thanks, Mina. And big tech is not alone in preparing for a second Trump term. Across the U.S. media landscape, there is a mix of anticipation and concern. For the pro-Trumpers, right-wing channels like Fox News Nation and online outlets, the, quote, free speech express will give them a lot more space. The rest, ranging from never-Trumpers to skeptics, are braced for impact. During his latest election campaign, Donald Trump attacked the media more than 100 times, took news outlets to court, and threatened to pull the licenses of broadcasters he does not like. With just days remaining before his second term, we spoke with three journalists about how they are preparing. All of our attempts to interview conservative voices and commentators failed. They either did not respond or refused to be filmed. Here is what those who did agree to talk to us had to say about Trump, the sequel.
Perfect. Yeah, right in there.
My first question is, how are you feeling on the cusp of Trump term two? Are you braced? Are you determined? Or are you exhausted already?
I feel as committed, galvanized, curious, extremely serious about what's going on today as I ever have. Our role as journalists is to hold those in power accountable. That was our job under Biden. It's our job under Trump. And we have a lot of work to do, to say the least.
You know, I mean, it's a great story. I think a lot of reporters, the ones who aren't totally burnt out at this point, are very energized by it because I think nobody knows what's going to happen.
I don't know that I'm feeling all that differently about the job of journalism from the way I was feeling about it before the election. I do think that, though, that this is a moment of real introspection for journalists as a whole. We have to think about why some of the stories that we published about Trump didn't really reach voters or weren't taken seriously by voters.
Even that enemy, too, when they're really the enemy, they're the enemy of the people, the press.
Trump hasn't even been sworn in as president yet, but he's going after the media in a way that's unprecedented.
To get me, somebody would have to shoot through the fake news. And I don't mind that so much.
He's also suing news outlets. He took ABC News to court because one of their star anchors, George Stephanopoulos, said Donald Trump had been found guilty in a civil trial of rape.
Donald Trump has been found liable for rape by a jury.
Now, what he'd been found guilty of was sexual assault, but the judge said that in common parlance, it would be known as rape. So many legal experts said the ABC lawyers could have defended it and won. But Disney Corporation, which owns ABC, has a lot of interests it wants to pursue during the Trump administration, and clearly they didn't want to squander any political capital on this. When wealthy media organizations fold in the face of a lawsuit from Trump, it makes it easier for him to sue again, which is what he immediately did.
President-elect Trump has sued the Des Moines Register and its retiring star pollster Ann Seltzer over a poll that had Vice President Harris ahead of him in Iowa. Trump ultimately did win Iowa. The suit argues the poll constituted election interference.
This poses a real danger. Trump and his team are going to step up their legal offensives against the media, and there need to be media outlets willing to take on these challenges and defend their work.
And we'll probably be filing a major lawsuit against them today or tomorrow. We're filing one on 60 Minutes, you know.
This country is going through a crisis of media and information worsened by the stream of lies and disinformation that people like Donald Trump and Elon Musk push out all the time. Billionaire media owners like Jeff Bezos at The Washington Post, Patrick Soon-Shiong at The Los Angeles Times, and social media magnates like Mark Zuckerberg of Meta, Facebook. all look like they're breaking what Yale University professor Timothy Snyder calls rule one in his book on tyranny. Don't obey in advance. The first two defy decades of traditions, pulling newspaper editorial endorsements of Kamala Harris prior to the election. And Zuckerberg lifted Facebook's ban on Donald Trump, then dined with him at Mar-a-Lago and had Meta donate $1 million to the Trump inaugural committee. These billionaires have a wide array of business interests and aren't going to jeopardize that with negative reporting. We have to continue to hold those in power accountable and at the same time be prepared to face attempts to intimidate or silence us. And that's where the power of an engaged audience comes in, demanding a genuine free press that reports without fear or favor. It's essential to the functioning of a democratic society.
I just want to thank everybody very much. I'm just telling you, this will be the golden age of America.
There's a big segment of journalists who were told that they were sort of warriors for the truth against Donald Trump instead of chroniclers of events as they happen.
Knowing helps us decide. Knowing keeps us free.
For a lot of the big publishers who are, by the way, struggling to keep their businesses alive, that was a very promising line of business to be the resistance. And you saw, in particular, the Washington Post change its slogan to "Democracy Dies in Darkness" and sell lots of subscriptions, basically on the promise that we're standing up to Donald Trump. It's really tough to keep telling this tale of crusading journalism. Jeff Bezos and Patrick Soon-Shiong are billionaires in heavily regulated industries, space and healthcare. And so they're pivoting very hard to ingratiate themselves to the new administration. And so now lots of their subscribers are understandably saying, wait, I bought, you know, this journalism that was marketed to me to save democracy, and now you're betraying that cause.
This is just the beginning. This is just the first episode. We are just getting started.
There's also this proliferation of new voices, which is a reality that professional journalists have to reckon with. These new guys have built an ecosystem of podcasts and YouTube channels, and they have audiences that aren't always plugged into politics, but in many ways they've replaced the mainstream media for a lot of people. And actually a lot of the mainstream liberal media class is essentially the butt of jokes in this online ecosystem.
Yes, hypocrisy is alive and well amongst these sanctimonious leftists. From Kimmel to De Niro to Stephanopoulos, they want you to believe they're better than you.
You know, Trump is really the reality now. And I think the way to tackle him is that we need to stay in our lane a bit more. The media for a period really liked to posture as combatants in a battle for democracy. You know, at Semaphore, we're really scrupulous about not lecturing our audience. We're trying to get away from the posturing about how media are the only true opposition to Trump. It's just not useful to anyone.
Mr. President, it's great to have you.
That was a nice introduction. Thank you very much.
You are a one of one.
Yeah, let's end the show right now.
Trump obviously used podcasts and that whole sphere of alternative media to great effect during the campaign. And that's a really important shift in political media and the media in general.
Your team and I want to shoot a TikTok with you.
Oh, that's good. I'm on TikTok.
It's not like the podcasters and streamers are the first of their kind to weave political commentary into non-news output. I mean, shows like Good Morning America, The View, even the late-night TV comics, they've all been doing it. But those guys have the trappings of the mainstream. There's a predictable format, sort of rehearsed pattern to the discussions. You still know very clearly when you're being delivered a political message.
Democracy dies in darkness. Yeah. Well, Jeff, you just turned the light off again. That's why people are mad.
This Donald Trump, he's like the emperor from Star Wars. He's old, he's evil, and he keeps coming back with no reasonable explanation whatsoever.
But the thing that's different about your Joe Rogans or, you know, the Twitch streamers you might find is that their political content is kind of unrehearsed. They'll be talking about wrestling, for instance, and then they'll mix in their political opinions as part of their just natural flow of conversation.
Nobody ever heard of. And all, now, it took her 2 months, but you know what? All of a sudden...
It caught fire.
I mean, the people are picking up political ideas ambiently. It's not like you tune in to Joe Rogan for a political update, necessarily. It's all kind of mixed together in a way that feels natural and unrehearsed. And I think that there are people who are bored with conventional media who find that really, really attractive.
Tonight, the high-stakes showdown here in Philadelphia between Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump.
I think we have to think hard as an industry about whether the way that we're producing political information is just too staid, whether we're producing content
content that actually reaches people where they're consuming media. The standard print press doesn't really cut it anymore. Twitter doesn't really cut it anymore. It's dwarfed by Instagram, dwarfed by YouTube, dwarfed by TikTok, and dwarfed by these alternative media outlets that Trump has been using to such great effect. If we're stuck in the old channels of media distribution and of distributing our journalism, we're not going to reach the people who most need to hear it, the people who are only peripherally engaged with politics. Those people end up making the difference in elections. And if they're not actually being served by mainstream media institutions, they're doing the rest of the country a huge, huge disservice.
The media's tamed down a little bit. They're liking us much better now, I think. If they don't, we'll have to just take them on again.
And finally, returning to Gaza, and an image captured just over 2 weeks ago. It shows a doctor, Hussam Abu Safiya, the director of what was one of the last barely functioning hospitals in northern Gaza, Kamal Adwan. The doctor is walking towards the Israeli forces that ordered the closure of that hospital. He then disappeared into Israeli custody. Too many other Palestinian doctors have been arrested, tortured, and even killed while held by Israel. It was one of those pictures that somehow resonated with people. To explain why and how that image was seen from inside Israel, we are revisiting our interview with the Israeli journalist Donna Mills.
Every war and every genocide have an iconic image. Whether it's the Vietnam War or the Holocaust, there's always an image that pops to our mind when we remember that historical moment. The image of Abu Safiya is an image of defiance. It's an image of resistance. And especially it's an image of humanity, of moment of humanity when humanity is very, very scarce. And I think that one of the reasons this image had stuck more than others at this moment, although we are very saturated with horrible, horrible photos of starving children and children who are freezing to death, is actually its lack of graphic effect. The fact that it's not shocking in its visuality, but its content is a very deeply human moment when humanity is very, very scarce. And when I first saw the image, it made me look in the mirror in a very different way. I feel that that image, that moment of Abu Safiya, is really a moment of reckoning for all of us in Israel, all of us who are complicit in this genocide, who are taking part in it in an active or passive way every day and are complicit in it, giving away our humanity every day in silence.
That was Al Jazeera's The Listening Post, and next we have commentary by Chris Hayes.
Since the end of the last world war, there have been basically two kind of competing visions of America's role in the world, at least among the two major parties. There's an international, liberal international view, right, that human rights should matter, that there should be a uniform standard globally that applies to every nation, including us, the U.S., and our allies. A regime of international norms, and most importantly, international law, like real international law, that the U.S. could shape and strengthen. Now, to be clear, I wasn't born yesterday. I'm not completely naive. Yes, that standard is one that is very, very often only given lip service to while the U.S. pursues pure power politics. But it is a meaningful and important standard, as is the aspiration towards reaching it and the people that advocate holding it as a standard. So that's one vision. And then there's a kind of standard reactionary vision, right-wing vision, which is that might makes right. Universal norms are fictions that can never really constrain us. We're the greatest country on earth. And because we are the greatest nation, it's just definitionally impossible for us or our allies to be on the wrong side of international law, which doesn't exist. And that view is strong and has a very long tradition. You could say it might have peaked or reached its apogee in the Cold War under Henry Kissinger, who sold successive administrations on dirty wars and proxy wars, and funding, training, and arming right-wing militaries to oppose left-wing governments or activists. He enabled deadly terror in Chile and Argentina and South Africa and Indonesia, where, to be clear, Kissinger's support for a right-wing dictator led to the genocide of 200,000 East Timorese people by a U.S.-equipped army, one of the great moral stains of U.S. foreign policy in the last 60 years. In El Salvador, where U.S.-backed forces fueled a civil war and murdered Catholic bishops, Catholic nuns, and social workers, an outrage that led the Carter administration to suspend military aid to the nation. And as the Cold War finally wound down, there was one lawmaker who made an indelible contribution to rolling back these abuses and attempting to set a standard for American behavior abroad and the behavior of our allies that we armed. That was Senator Pat Leahy, Democrat of Vermont, in 1997.
So-called Leahy Law expands our current law and seeks to ensure that United States assistance does not go to individuals who abuse human rights, to do everything possible to assure that in our efforts to support foreign security forces, that we respect human rights, we also prevent those who abuse human rights from receiving our assistance.
Seems straightforward. Leahy Law barred the Pentagon and the Department of State from transferring U.S. arms to countries that we thought were committing human rights abuses. And that is what I keep thinking of as I process the news that on the way out the door, the Biden administration is going to transfer $8 billion more in weapons to Israel, including fighter jets and attack helicopters, bombs, warheads, and artillery shells. $8 billion in weaponry given over to an ally waging what I think can only be described as total war in Gaza that has, according to, I think, multiple independent experts and reports, reporters and NGOs, been committing war crimes and ethnic cleansing, according to a former Israeli defense minister, where Israeli soldiers say they have been ordered to target and kill innocents arbitrarily, including children, and that they have used Palestinians as human shields for their operations in Gaza. As whistleblowers and detainees say, the Israeli authorities regularly torture Palestinian prisoners. The UN says Israel is using starvation as a strategy in Gaza. Amnesty International says Israel is committing a genocide. Dozens of doctors, nurses, and paramedics who volunteered in Gaza and were there and saw up close told the New York Times they'd seen, as you see the images there in front of you, multiple children who were shot in the head or chest, bullets. And they even brought back the x-rays you're seeing right now to prove it, so people would believe that they had seen children with bullets lodged in their skulls. As Congresswoman Katie Porter pointed out in a House hearing last year, the U.S. ban on arms transfers to human rights abusers, the Leahy Law, has one big exception.
State Department says that aid should stop immediately if there's a problem, does it?
It totally depends on the circumstances and situation.
Does it depend on the country that's getting the aid?
It also depends on the country receiving the aid. Yes.
So what country does aid not stop immediately under Leahy?
I'd have to go back and look through my notes.
You don't know what country that is? It's only one in the entire world. Guess what? Except for Israel.
Even now, former Senator Pat Leahy, who's no longer in the Senate, says Israel is getting a pass in violation of the spirit, if not the letter, of the law that he helped pass. Beginning in the early 2000s, I wrote to successive secretaries of state about the failure to apply the Leahy Law to Israel. The responses were either inconclusive or inaccurately claimed the law was being applied to Israel the same as to other countries, which the State Department continues to insist today. Leahy added the State Department's dismissive response not only beggars credulity, it also makes a mockery of the law. This is Pat Leahy, liberal senator, not a radical, right? Not a fringe voice in American politics. Someone who knows this issue, who spent decades working on this issue, and not just about Israel, about all kinds of American allies. And yet here we are. President Biden is going to hand a blank check for Israel over to the incoming Trump administration. I don't think it's coincidental that yesterday on Capitol Hill, the House overwhelmingly passed a bill to sanction officers of the International Criminal Court to punish them for moving to charge top Israeli leaders, including Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, with war crimes. Keep in mind, the ICC also indicted leaders of Hamas for their war crimes appropriately and their holding of Israeli hostages, which continues to this very day. And 45 Democrats joined all Republicans to support this bill. We know which vision of American global engagement the Trump administration will carry out. But it isn't just Trump who this week is making an absolute mockery of every last lecture we deliver to the Russians or the Chinese or anyone else about respecting human rights and international law. It is President Joe Biden, too, leaving a disgraceful legacy. A liberal president doing untold damage to the liberal international order.